At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush hopes to lead every American into the markets, waving the flag of the ownership society. But the first steps in can be daunting ones, and the president's timing is rough. With stock prices high, bonds wobbly, and the real estate market looking toppy, even financial experts can't figure out where to put their money right now. And a wrong move, or just bad luck, can wipe out a lifetime of savings, just when we're being told to be ready to go it alone. Tonight we'll hear from some of the country's top financial thinkers on what to do to prepare for the future. This hour On Point, the challenge of the ownership society when everything in the market looks overpriced. We begin with a look at what financial advisors around the country are telling their clients. Paul Lim is financial correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and a contributor to the New York Times Sunday Business section. His column, All Dressed Up and Nowhere to Invest, appeared in the Times this past weekend. Paul Lim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom.
So you painted a picture of even the pros not knowing which way to turn right now. What's the perspective you heard, Paul?
Well, you know, normally in a given market, there's usually one asset class that seems to be a no-brainer when it comes to finding something at a low price.
One sector's up, another sector's down, that's where you go.
Exactly. They always say that stocks zig when bonds zag, but right now we're having a case where there's clearly a feeling that the fixed income market is pricey right now.
Okay, let's translate a lot of this. Fixed income, that is?
Bonds. That as interest rates are rising, as market interest rates rise, conversely, bond prices fall. So the value of your underlying portfolio could be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So rising periods of rising interest rates are not a great time to be stepping into a bond fund, for example.
Okay.
So that's dicey because we know the Fed's going to move interest rates higher at the short end, and we know long-term market interest rates have been rising lately.
Right.
So we've just been through about a two and a half year stretch of a decent market rally here. 2003 was fantastic for the equity markets. 2004 was a good representation of what happens in second years of market rallies.
And now it's bumping up toward 11,000 on the Dow.
We're nearing a four-year high on the Dow. So there's no real slam dunk. I mean, there are places where, I mean, this is typically called a stock picker's market where there's no real kind of clear-cut answer as to where you put your money in equities. People have individual guesses on individual securities.
You quote professionals at this point saying there's no shame in going to cash if you don't like stocks.
Now, here again, I think we should be mindful of the fact that they're talking about incrementally going to cash, that if you don't know where to put that next dollar to work, don't try to force it necessarily into the equity markets or to the bond markets. There's no shame in going to cash with that extra dollar. Now, clearly, there's a desire on the part of professionals that we stay diversified throughout all these periods of time, that we be long-term investors,
right,
so that you have a core amount of money in stocks and in bonds and in a mix of different assets.
And what about real estate, Paul? That's traditionally been where a lot of consumers have turned, maybe the biggest asset for
real estate has been a great help during this during the downturn in the economy and during the downturn in the equity markets, clearly. That's where our wealth or the perception of our wealth has certainly come from. The real estate markets nationally are on a tear, and they're, you know, clearly with mortgage rates relatively low by historic standards still, despite a recent slight uptick. There's nothing to say that the real estate market necessarily is ready to pop because people are talking about bubbles with regard to the real estate market.
Might be, might not be a bubble.
It's hard to say because the real estate market is so local, so I think it's unfair to call it a bubble or at least a singular bubble.
In national terms,
But you've got to realize that we've been through a period of time, a spectacular period of time, when we entered into a bear market with stocks, we entered into a fantastic bull market for real estate, and people are now talking about real estate like we talked about net stocks back in the late 90s,
right,
which is, let me cash everything out and put it there without thinking of diversifying, without thinking of buying low and selling high.
So here we are at this moment where there are no delicious, alluring alternatives, just when millions and millions of boomers are praying that they can bring in a decent return to make up for maybe a lack of savings earlier in their lives, praying that they can put together a portfolio that will help them go into retirement. President Bush says we all should.
Well, you know, I think the lack of savings is the underlying kind of context with which we view all of this. The fact that we haven't been saving throughout the downturn in the economy most recently, but also the upturn in the late 90s during that fantastic period of time, we really didn't put money away. So now we're left with the prospect of having to be investors in a broad sense. As workers, but also as individuals, as households, we need to invest to care for our retirements. But there isn't, at least in this short-term period of window of time, a real easy kind of suggestion as to where to go for opportunity. But, you know, we should be mindful of the fact that if we're, you know, boomers especially, younger folks more so, that we're talking about a fairly long time horizon before you get to retirement. So we shouldn't necessarily be worried about not being able to find a bargain today. Hopefully, if we've been doing it well and if we've been doing it responsibly and we don't take too many risks, we don't necessarily need to hit a home run today. We, as long as we kind of progress slowly over the years, hopefully we can get to where we want to go.
But where to put that next dollar right now, maybe nobody knows. Paul Lim, you've laid it out for us nicely. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Paul Lim is financial correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and a contributor to The New York Times. He spoke with me from Boston. We are talking tonight about President Bush's ownership society and the challenge of investing for the on-your-own future when everything in the market seems overpriced right now. You can join the conversation. Have you pulled together a grubstake for the ownership society, and where are you investing it now? Where are you putting your money now for a return that will one day let you send your kids to college, maybe retire? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Jeremy Siegel. He's professor of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His big 1994 book, Stocks for the Long Run, was a kind of Bible of 90s bull market investors. His new book is The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph. Jeremy Siegel, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being back on Point.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So you gave heart to a lot of people in the 90s. Stocks for the Long Run was a kind of watchword, a kind of catchphrase that people really locked into. Now you're back on the other side of a pretty good-sized market, not crash, but a heck of a fall that burned a lot of people. And what's your message now, Jeremy Siegel?
Well, certainly you're perfectly right. The 90s are gone. In fact, the 80s and 90s produced 12% to 15% annual returns in the stock market.
Which historically is just over the moon.
It's over the moon. It's actually more than twice the long-run average. So we're not going back there. We live in a world of lower returns. I think Paul is certainly right. I think what we have to look around, and you mentioned those three asset classes. We have stocks, we have bonds, and we have real estate. To me, stocks are still the most attractive of those three classes.
Even now, when the Dow's getting up near 11,000, the NASDAQ has risen from the dead, very high price equity earnings ratios, and you're still saying to, you know, Joe Sixpack, who President Bush wants to be in the market, put your next hard-earned dollar in the stock market?
Well, it depends, of course, of where you stand financially right now. But, when we take a look, you mentioned price earnings ratio. Those are good measures of valuation. And the long-run average is around 15, and we're about 18 to 20. That's not really that much over the average. And I think there's good reasons why stocks should be higher today than they were before. But when I look at bonds, 4%, 4.5% for 10, 30-year bonds with no possibilities of growth and no protection for inflation, I think stocks are, compared to bonds right now, a slam dunk.
You say the future is bright, but you're not really voting for the sort of easy way into the market anymore, the index fund that helps you invest in the whole market. One would think that if we are pushing toward an ownership society where a lot of people without a whole lot of experience are going to get into the market, that would seem like a relatively easy option. You're saying that's not the place to go.
Well, I'm not backing away from there completely by any means. In fact, what I recommend is that half your equity portfolio still be indexed. And by the way, indexed to the world. That became very much more important as I did my research.
That is not just American stocks, but global kind of index funds.
European, Asian stocks are also going to be very important in the future. But I also found that there are certain classes of stocks, high dividend stocks, low PE stocks, certain sectors like pharmaceutical sectors, the recently battered pharmaceuticals, consumer staples sectors, even the energy sectors that have done very well over the long run. And I think that by prudently weighing your portfolio into certain sectors and low valuation price stocks, that you can do better than indexing.
And you're saying not the fancy new stocks on the market, not the fancy high-tech stocks, but kind of the staples of every economy.
Right. You know, technology has not been a good long-term hold, no matter how important it is, and it is very important to the advancement of our economy. The sands just shift too rapidly. There's too much competition. It's very, very hard to establish a place and keep it there. Even, you know, the venerable IBM, the great stock of the 50s and 60s, faltered afterwards before recovering. I find that the technology is not a very good long-term hold. The healthcare is one of the few innovative groups that has been a good long-term hold. And a lot of that, by the way, is what we call the brand name stocks. Consumer staples, Coca-Cola's, Pepsi-Cola's, Procter and Gamble's, Heinz, Wrigley's. These stocks have been around for you and me for decades, and believe it or not, they've been the winners in the long run for investors.
Right down there with the real basics, nothing fancy. Jeremy Siegel, the Wizard of Wharton, is with us tonight. His new book is The Future for Investors. Lots of investors scratching their heads about that right now. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you saving and investing for your future? Where are you putting your money now for a return that might one day send your kids to college, let you retire? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the challenge of the ownership society right now. Where to invest when everything looks high? It used to be a kind of private matter. Now it's basically public policy, or President Bush would like to see it that way. You can join the conversation tonight with the Dow nearing 11,000 again, housing over the moon, bonds wobbly. What is an investor to do? Were you burned when the 90s bubble burst? Are you worried about being burned again? Are you still a believer in stocks for the long run? And what's going to happen when all those boomers start to unload? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Philadelphia by Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He was author of Stocks for the Long Run. In 1994, it came out. His new book is The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph Over the Bold and New. And with me in the studio right now, I'm joined by Zvi Bodie. He's professor of finance and economics at Boston University School of Management. His latest book is Worry-Free Investing, A Safe Approach to Achieving Your Lifetime Financial Goals. Zvi Bodie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here we are. We're not really accustomed to talking about stock picking, but as I say, it's something like national policy. Now, people are told if you ever want to retire, don't count on Social Security. Get out there and invest. This is what people are supposed to cling to and thrive with as they go through life. Jeremy Siegel is very upbeat. He says there's a lot of opportunity right now. Stocks are the place to be, and he's got a formula for doing it. You've tended to be more conservative over time, as I read you, Zvi Bodie. When you look at the options right now, what's your advice to American investors?
Well, my advice is think about the risk as well as the expected return. My good friend Jeremy, who I would point out, was a classmate and a fellow student of Paul Samuelson's at MIT.
Great.
Back in the early 70s.
Yep.
Jeremy, who I'm not necessarily disagreeing with, is focusing on the expected rate of return. But when you talk about the stock market, you have to recognize that there's significant risk associated with stock market investing. And I'm concerned about all of those people, and there are many, I'm one of them, who are risk averse, not just with respect to the short run, but in the long run as well. And for me, the very first asset class that I talk about is not any of the three that have been mentioned so far in this program.
It is stock, bonds, and real estate.
Right. What I talk about are Treasury inflation-protected securities.
So TIPS, TIPS.
Correct. Now, these securities did not exist up until 1997, at least not in the United States.
And what are they?
These are fixed-income securities. They're essentially bonds, but they have a feature which makes them very, very different from conventional bonds that Jeremy talks about in his books.
Mm-hmm.
These are bonds which are guaranteed to beat inflation by a certain percentage.
But by quite a small percentage.
Well, that's right.
By 1% or 1.5%?
Right. And as any finance professor will tell you, there is a trade-off between risk and reward. That is to say, if you want to go for a higher expected return, or if you want to avoid the risk of the mm-hmm. stock market, mm-hmm. you've got to settle for a lower rate of return.
Zifa, Bodhi, this is no joke right now. We came through the 20 years that Jeremy Siegel was talking about, that we heard from Paul Lim. Things were great, 80s and 90s overall. Everybody seems to agree now, and Jeremy Siegel just said, that period is over. But here we've got millions and millions of boomers retiring. Social Security is supposed to be in trouble. Lots of people have not saved enough. So the temptation to go for stock market-sized returns, at least what we've seen in the last couple of decades, is very great. Otherwise, lots of people can't figure out how to retire. If everybody or most people went with your more conservative approach, could they ever retire?
Well, sure they can, but they're gonna have to recognize the fact that they probably won't be retiring as early as they had hoped. The allure of worry-free investing in inflation-protected securities, is that whatever you save will be there. You know it will be there. It is guaranteed to beat inflation. I would venture to say that an awful lot of people in this country, if you told them that there is a secure way for them to invest their savings for the long run that is guaranteed to beat inflation, would say, that's where I want to put a lot of my money.
Jeremy Siegel, how do you see this? This is no longer just the smart set, the wise guys, stockbrokers doing this. Defined benefit retirement plans have gone away. People are relying on 401ks. The return that they manage to produce on those is very important if they're lucky enough to have a 401k. So how do you see it? Is it everybody in the pool, everybody in the market? Because otherwise you won't have enough to retire on?
Well, first let me say that I have been an enthusiast of these TIPS bonds just like Zvi has. But one has to remember, when they first came out, that margin was 3.5% over inflation. In fact, it went all the way up in 2000 to 4.5%.
Looked
and
pretty good, though not compared to...
That was a great
to,
deal.
Yeah.
Right. But now, as you mentioned yourself, Tom, they are 1.5% above inflation. And even if you believe, and I do, that stock returns are not going to be quite as robust as their long-run average. 6.5 to 7 is what I have found over very long periods of time after inflation rate of return. Even if you take it down a point, which I think is very possible given the type of world we live in, it still beats these bonds hands down. The margin is just, I think, too great to ignore for investors.
But what if, when at the same time this huge wave of boomers is headed toward retirement, what if we fall in a ditch? What if that long-term return you describe doesn't materialize for 5, 10, 15 years while millions of Americans are hoping, trying to retire?
Well, that's a very important question, is what I discuss in the book, The Future for Investors. What I find is that the rest of the world becomes critical in providing growth and ensuring that equity returns are going to be quite good into the coming decades. If we just looked at our aging society ourselves, and it's even worse, as we know, in Japan and in Europe, mm-hmm. We do get a tremendous downshift of growth and return. But when you look at the rest of the world, where, by the way, over 80% of the people are located, you don't find that downshift. You don't find the same aging and baby boomer problems. And I pin a lot of my work and expectations on their continuing growth.
So you're saying cheer for China. In your first chapter, you write, "The future is bright. Our world today stands at the brink of the greatest burst of invention, discovery, and economic growth ever known. The pessimists who proclaim that the retiring baby boomers will bankrupt Social Security, upend our private pension systems, and crash the financial markets are wrong." And you're pinning a lot of that confidence, that optimism, on growth overseas. How does that help American investors who may be in the U.S. markets, Jeremy Siegel?
Well, we American investors can participate in those foreign markets. Over 50% of the world's equity capital is now headquartered outside the United States. In my book, I recommend that individuals try for 40% of their stocks in the foreign markets. And that, I don't just mean China and India, because sometimes they themselves get very overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
Europe, the rest of Asia, even in Japan, I know that has not done well. But my belief is that when I look at the world economy into the future, when I see the communications revolution, the fact that 2.5 billion Chinese and Indians are now engaging in the research process, I think there's going to be some very good gains in productivity ahead, and we're going to see a very, very different world by mid-century.
And what about the U.S. markets for people who aren't adventurous enough to be in world index funds or investing abroad? Are you anticipating money coming in from newly affluent investors abroad to prop up the U.S. market or not?
Yes, most definitely. And that has a lot to do with the age profile. They're much younger. They're going to be entering the same accumulation phase that we were in the 80s and 90s. I believe that, the acquisition of IBM's personal computers by Lenovo and Mittal.
This is the Chinese firm.
The
yes.
Chinese, mm-hmm. the Chinese firm, the Indian firm Lakshmi Mittal Ispat, mm-hmm. which acquired Bethlehem Steel.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the tip of the iceberg. I think we're going to see huge acquisitions by foreign firms of American divisions abroad, and I believe also that we're going to see a lot of American firms, already multinational firms, moving into those markets and earning profits from doing so.
Zvi Bodhi, there it is. Jeremy Siegel says, don't worry, the rest of this booming, much younger world will float our boats.
Yeah, you know, that kind of talk really worries me. Not because I necessarily disagree with the optimistic scenario. It's just that we live in a real world, and the real world is highly uncertain. Let me just put this thought into everybody's mind as a counterpoint to the enthusiasm that Jeremy is expressing. Think back to the 1980s.
Okay.
Back in the 1980s, virtually every economist, with few exceptions, were pointing to what economy as the economy that was going to be leading the world into the bright new future.
Japan, off she goes.
Okay. What happened to the Japanese economy between then and now?
Crashed and stalled out for a decade or more.
Okay. Now, keep that in mind every time you start getting super enthusiastic about economic scenarios for the future. It simply shows how hard it is to predict. And that's my point. If Jeremy were willing, and I don't say this just to Jeremy, but to all
this
the optimists about,
yeah.
Right. All of these folks who are so enthusiastic about the long run for the stock market and who tell people, who are investing their hard-earned money don't worry, would they be willing to write a guarantee against a stock market
but,
decline?
But we know there are no guarantees. With
no,
your
there aren't. Tom, excuse me, there are guarantees. They're called put options.
But not for the kind of returns
for the
that people expect. So here's my question to you. With that perspective, Zvibody, would you have missed all the historic gains of the stock market?
No, absolutely not. I got into the market big time in the early 80s when the price-to-earnings ratio on the S&P 500 mm-hmm. was down at 8.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually everybody I knew, every serious economist I knew, was saying the market is undervalued. Mm. I felt that way. I was giving interviews saying the market is undervalued. But we're a long way from there right now. I'm not saying you won't earn the 5% or the 6% inflation-adjusted returns that Jeremy is talking about. I'm saying it's highly uncertain. And so if you are as a prudent investor like me, what you would do is lock in that level of retirement income that you absolutely feel you need to have
mm-hmm.
by investing in the safest investments available.
That presumes you've got the nut collected that will get you
absolutely.
To that. I mean, many Americans were thinking in the 90s they were going to invest their way to that retirement
peace of mind.
Well,
they were dreaming.
Yeah, a lot of them turned out to be. Jeremy Siegel, Zvibody, I want to begin to bring our callers in. A lot of them are waiting patiently there. John is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, John, you're on the air.
I have this problem you're talking about. I have this big nut.
Yes, okay.
And I'm just trying to preserve it. I'm 45 years old.
Right.
I worked for a high-flying company in the 90s and made a ton of money on options.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple million bucks.
Hey, good for you, but you're way out of the game. Do you know where to put it now?
Well, that's the thing. So, I'm 45 years old. I got young teenagers. I've got 15 more years of work to do, and I'm wondering, how can I preserve this thing? Everything I look at scares me, and I've got way too much money in a 2% money market right now. It's a spooky thing.
So you're not talking about making the money you need for retirement. You've got a big chunk of it, but you're worried simply about how to preserve it.
And actually, it's this inflation adjusted bit. That's the tough part. I mean, I can make 2%, but I think that's negative 3% inflation adjusted.
So let's get advice from both of my panelists here. Jeremy Siegel, first to you. Lucky John in Cary, North Carolina. He's 45, and he's already got $2 million socked away. He doesn't want to see it eaten away by inflation sitting in a 2% return account, but he doesn't know where to put it.
Well, John is not only has a nice nut, he's a young man, in my opinion.
Yes.
He's got lots of years in front of them, lots of good, healthy years, I certainly hope.
Though not everybody gets a second swing at putting $2 million in the bank.
That's absolutely true. But, when you look ahead 15, 20, 25, even 30 years, and I know you're going to be putting some of that away certainly for your retirement and maybe even for your children, that's where I think you can well afford to be diversified in stocks. And again, not just the tech or internet sector or one or two, but worldwide diversification, which gives you the most stability and the lowest risk. My belief is that the margin, that expected return that, Zvi is talking about is enough that it will, with very high probability, give you much fatter returns in the future. Yes, some should always, Zvi, I'm not saying no one should invest in bonds. I'm just saying that those returns are so low now that anyone that has years in front of them, my feeling is the preponderance should be in stocks.
And Zvi, speak to John. $2 million in the bank. For some others, it may be $200,000. Others, maybe $20,000. But it's what they've got. What would you do with it now?
Well, my question for John would be, if I can show you a way, John, to lock in a rate of return that is going to beat inflation by 1.8% per year, right up until age, whenever you plan to retire, 65, 70, How much of your money would you like to lock up in that way?
John, are you willing to put your money where it's going to get 1.8% ahead of inflation? Is that exciting, enticing, good enough?
It's probably the kind of things that, you know, these are the kinds of offers you get made, like annuities and things like that, that are kind of marginally interesting.
You'd like a bigger return, but you don't want to lose it.
Well, I know. Well, that's the thing. You think about these historic S&P returns of 10-11%, and then you say, that's what I'd really like to have. And at the same time, though, I just want to make sure that I don't, you know, that I don't end up at 65 broke.
John, we've got it. We've just got a few seconds before the break. Your advice is you're putting him right back.
Well, he seems to be talking out of both sides of his mouth.
Well,
I'll tell you what I would.
All. Everybody wants a great return and security.
I talk to an awful lot of people who've read my book who say, thank God, I don't want to take any risk. People like John who would put 80%, 90% of what they've got into long-term Treasury inflation-protected bonds.
And they can sleep well at night, but they're not going to get that Warren Buffett-sized return. Zvi Bodhi, author of Worry-Free Investing. Jeremy Siegel's new book is The Future for Investors. Listeners, you can join us as well tonight. Where are you putting your hard-earned dollars right now in our ownership society? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the challenge of the ownership society right now, where to invest when everything looks high. You can join the conversation this evening. Will booming economies abroad support the U.S. market or drain it? And how are you thinking about investment options now? Are you thinking about them, or are you just closing your eyes and praying? President Bush wants all Americans in the market. Are all Americans prepared to navigate these waters? Are you? Where's your next 401k contribution going? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Jeremy Siegel, a professor of finance at the Wharton School. His new book is The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph Over the Bold and New. And by Zvi Bodhi from Boston University's School of Management. His latest book is Worry-Free Investing, A Safe Approach to Achieving Your Lifetime Financial Goals. And you can sure hear the contrast in their advice. Let's take another call. Zach is calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually a student of, I was a student of Professor Bodhi 17 years ago.
Okay.
His advice served me very well over the years. You know, you talked about real estate earlier tonight.
Yes.
And if you look at value of housing in the country right now as compared to renting the same property, is way out of line. The Economist had an article about it, the decision to buy or rent. And any way I look at it, and by the way, I finance a lot of real estate. I make a lot of money in it.
And are you saying it looks better to buy or to rent now?
It's absolutely better to rent. I don't know why anybody would buy a house.
Yikes, you're scaring everybody who owns a house out there.
Well, I own two of them myself, and I got to tell you, it's the dumbest thing I ever did, but I got kids. And it's been wonderful. It's gone up, but it's if you look at the mathematics of it, and the blind hand of economics eventually has to bring it in line, housing prices are way above what should be.
So what's your question tonight, Zach?
My question is, once the real estate market, this bubble will burst, like all the other bubbles that burst in the past. Once it does burst because of rising interest rates, that is going to affect the stock market. And I do agree with Professor Bodhi that once that does burst, you're going to see not a good situation out there.
Yep, that's everybody's fear.
With NASDAQ, it's going to spread to the rest of the market. It's going to go from real estate to the bond market to the stock market.
Zach, I'll put that to Zvi Bodhi, but what are you doing?
What I'm doing, I'm sitting in cash, and I want to talk about the tips.
The Treasury protected securities, inflation protected.
The way they calculate inflation is that about 50% of the CPI is based on price of housing, and they use rent as the indicator of price of to calculate CPI. They don't use price of houses; they use the rent. Rents have been going down because of overcapacity of apartments.
So you're afraid that though it looks like they're keeping up with inflation, it may not actually be doing it.
That might actually not be the case.
Yep, we've got it. Zach, thanks very much for your call. Zvi Bodhi, first to you. Here's your former student. He liked your advice 17 years ago. He's done well by it. Now he's worried about everything, the value of housing. What happens to the market of housing if it goes down?
Hi, Zach. I remember you well.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, let me agree with you that there's certainly parts of the country, in particular the urban areas, where housing does seem out of sight. But bear in mind that for many people, investing in their own home is, in fact, a risk-reducing type of investment. It's not like investing in the stock market. Because if you have found a place that you want to live, buying your own home is, in effect, a hedge. It's risk-reducing. You are protected against rent increases.
But let me ask you about that, Z-Body, if I may, because I think a lot of boomers right now, if they're lucky enough to own a home and they've seen the value go up, they've got a calculation in the back of their minds like this. Okay, we haven't saved enough, but when the time comes, we'll sell this house, realize a wonderful gain, move off to Florida or Arizona, somewhere where housing is cheaper, or who knows, Costa Rica by that time, and live off the difference. But Zach's saying, you know what? If this market goes down, they may not have any big gain to ride off into the sunset on.
Well, that's true, but bear in mind that if real estate as a whole moves up or down together everywhere, then if you sell your house for less than you expected, you'll be able to buy your retirement home for less than you expected as well.
But you're not going to be sitting on that margin of cash that you might draw down on in later years. I want to get one more voice in this conversation. Joining us tonight from Montreal is Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at economy.com, an economic consulting firm. Mark Zandi, great to have you with us tonight.
It's good to be with you.
So we've got Jeremy Siegel with us. And Zvi Bodhi, we've heard earlier about this dilemma, even for pros right now, not knowing where to put their next investment dollar. And this in a context where President Bush is asking everybody to be in the market. Do you see the dilemma that Americans might feel they're facing right now, Mark Zandi, about where to go with that investment to build the nest egg, to retire, put their kids in college?
Well, you know, I think the most important point is that people need to save more. We can debate about where to put your money. But I think that's a small issue, that the bigger issue is that we're just not saving enough, and that everyone should really consider the fact that returns in the long run probably won't measure up to what we've even experienced in the recent past. And what that would imply is that we just need to save more if we're going to have a comfortable retirement.
But the instant that people save some money, they have the question of what to do with it. And right now, I hear an awful lot of people who may not have a whole lot of money, but they know they're supposed to maximize it, saying they don't know what to do with it.
Well, I mean, I think that depends on your risk tolerance, how much risk you're willing to take. It depends on what your horizon is, which is really a function of how old you are, how many children you have, how old are they, are they approaching college age. I mean, that's a question that it does not have a simple answer, and there's not one answer for everybody. Everyone needs to carefully think about what their goals are and what their horizon is, and then based on that, they can make some logical, I think, decisions about where to put their money.
And finally, Mark Zandi, Jeremy Siegel's making the argument that global markets and surging economies, China, India, others, are going to bail us out here as the boomers start to get out of the American market, out of the American workforce, that the dynamism of economies abroad will continue to float everybody's boat. What do you say?
Yeah, no, that's a reasonable argument. That is a reasonable argument. What it means, though, is that U.S. investors have to look overseas, that they can't stick just to the U.S. market. We are increasingly in a global economy, and if you just decide that you're going to invest in the United States, you're not going to do quite as well as if you become a little bit more global in your orientation. So it's not an unreasonable argument. And I think it's a good argument that he's making, that we need to be more global in our investment strategies and thinking.
Mark Zandi with economy.com in Montreal tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Joyce is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Joyce. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Joyce. What are you thinking?
Well, what I'm thinking is I bought a condo in Maryland, mm-hmm. and for cash, and I haven't sold the other house yet in Buffalo. And, of course, the Buffalo house isn't going to get the same money that I had to pay for the condo in Maryland.
May I ask you, Joyce, is this you're moving to Maryland for another job, or you're retiring, or what's the condo?
I have family there. I don't have much family left in Buffalo.
Right. So you've got two pieces of property now.
So I have two pieces of property, but I just don't know, with all the corporate greed and all the scandals and stuff, I tend to just stick the money in the money market and let it sit. But I, you know, now I've got, eventually I will sell this place and have some money, and I just don't know what to do with it.
Joyce, let me ask, if I may, how old are you?
I'm 73.
Okay, we'll put that in our magical analysis machine here. Jeremy Siegel, if I may turn to you on that. Joyce, it sounds like she's almost afraid to sell the house she's no longer going to be living in because she doesn't know what to do with the cash once she does. She's 73. People live a long time these days. What's your advice to her?
Well, for Joyce and Zach that we heard before, I really sympathize with their problems. Everyone is concerned about real estate. I think one thing is very, very important, and Zach pointed it out. He thought it was a bubble. It is a bubble if interest rates start going up. But if interest rates start going up, housing is going to go down. But you know what's going to be hit the worst? Bonds, because by the very nature, bonds will go down by construction when interest rates rise.
Sure, but doesn't it bite the market as well? That's Zach's concern.
Yes, a bit it will, but my belief is that when we see the global growth that I think is going to pull up interest rates. I mean, I agree with Greenspan, what he said a month ago. He says, I'm puzzled. Why are interest rates so low? It almost looks like the market listened to him because they're more than 0.5% higher than when he spoke.
Yeah.
But once we see this global growth and we see that happening, it's going to raise interest rates. And it's not going to hurt stock prices as much because growth means higher profits to offset the interest rates.
And you say look for what you call El Dorado companies, these with big dividends. Reinvest those dividends and off you go.
Right. And what's so important, I mean, Zvi talked about protecting yourself on the downside. And one class of stocks that I found was very, very useful and important in protecting yourself on the downside were high dividend paying stocks. They have done wonderfully both in the 74-75 bear market and in the last bear market. So I'm very sensitive also. People want to avoid the crash of those speculative stocks. And what I try to do is point out that, you know what, there are classes of stocks out there that aren't so speculative and that give you downside protection.
Jeremy Siegel, as we move in, or at least President Bush trying to lead the country into this ownership society direction, more personal responsibility for everything around retirement, do you think Americans broadly, in their many millions, have the savvy and the stomach for this game?
I think if you want to know the truth, a lot of people are worried about, oh my goodness, another set of choices that I have to make with mm-hmm. Social Security. I almost recommended that Bush start very patiently, maybe even Zvi would like this, that they just put the money right into a bond fund like the Social Security Trust Fund, but have that marked off as your money and get quarterly statements how much it's worth. And then after a few years, if people are comfortable with that, they can then diversify into equity. I do think that President Bush is perhaps biting off a little too much. People are just too worried at the present time to go all out into personal accounts, which I think are fundamentally a wonderful thing, but out of the traditional Social Security.
And Zvi Bode, we've just got half a minute left, but the stomach, the savvy, is it out there for the many millions of Americans looking to retire one day? To be in the market, in that game?
I think, sure, as long as they've got the downside protection. So I would say most people ought to be locking in that standard of living that they absolutely feel they need to have.
With inflation-protected securities.
Right. And then taking risks with the extra.
Nail it down first and go from there. You're both very generous with your perspective tonight. Zvi Bode with the Boston University School of Management, latest book, Worry-Free Investing. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeremy Siegel, always fascinating to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us. The new book is The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph Over the Bold and New. Jeremy, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
In a moment, a high profit conviction related to the corporate accounting scandals. This is On Point. Former WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers was convicted today on 9 counts of conspiracy and fraud for his role in the accounting scandal that led to the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. The New York jury delivered its verdict after 40 hours of deliberation over 8 days. With the conviction, Ebbers becomes the most prominent executive yet to be convicted in the accounting scandals that have rocked the corporate world since the late 90s. Ebbers, who is 63, could spend much of the rest of his life behind bars. Joining me now is Steve Rosenbusch, senior writer at Businessweek Online, who's covering the Ebbers trial. Steve, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what do you think decided this case in the end? Why is Bernie Ebbers headed off to jail?
Well, I think that the prosecution was hoping that the testimony of the company's former chief financial officer, Scott Sullivan, would be enough in and of itself to win a conviction. But, you know, obviously he pleaded guilty in the case, and there was plenty of reason for jurors to doubt the quality or the truthfulness of his testimony.
That is, Scott Sullivan pled guilty and became a kind of a state's, what do you call it, state's evidence. He was testifying for the state against Ebbers.
Exactly. So they're really testifying on a mountain, pinning their hopes on a mountain of circumstantial evidence, none of it which absolutely for sure linked Ebbers to the fraud, but, you know, all of which sort of in the aggregate created a picture in which it was almost impossible to believe that he didn't know what was going on.
This is a man, Bernie Ebbers, who appeared to be worth many hundreds of millions of dollars when things were riding high.
Well over a billion.
Well over a billion, with his cowboy boots and his gray hair and beard. And he cut quite a figure, former coach, former club bouncer, former milkman, then billionaire plus. On June 13th, he'll be sentenced, and he could face 85 years in prison, that's essentially a life sentence.
Well, at his age, it's essentially 2 life sentences. I don't think that he really truly faces 85 years, but there's no question that he's headed for jail for a significant amount of time, unless of course his lawyer prevails in the appeals process.
His lawyer today said that they're all devastated and that they will appeal. But of that 85-year possible, do you have any sense, Steve, of where the judge is likely to come down on sentencing?
I don't think at this point that there's any way to know exactly how much time he'll face. I think it appears to me that the judge has a fair amount of discretion.
What is the message that goes out from this conviction of a very high-profile, very wealthy American corporate executive when he, at age 63, is facing potentially 85 years? It'll be less, but it'll be a lot. What's the message to the corporate world?
The message to the corporate world is very clear. It's that senior executives and CEOs in particular will be held responsible for everything that goes on within their companies, and they better take charge of it, and that they can't hide behind the defense which has been used in the past, that they didn't know what was going on. They can't simply throw down the gauntlet to prosecutors and say, well, sure, maybe you think that I knew what was going on, but you prove it. Because what we've seen now is that the prosecutors can simply look the jury, the jurors in the eye and say, use your common sense, and the jurors have the legal right to do that.
Is this the kind of conviction that changes a corporate culture in this country?
I think it's going to have a huge impact. I mean, this was the largest bankruptcy in history, the largest accounting scandal in history, and this was a stock that really helped redefine the stock market as a mass market phenomenon. There was a tremendous amount of public interest in this case, and I think that will carry over into the story.
And Bernie Ebbers convicted. Steve Rosenbusch at Businessweek, thanks for being with us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.